Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nikki Huff. With many instances of deplatforming and censorship taking place online, it reminds us of the perilous power imbalances caused by the lack of transparency and democratic accountability when it comes to privatized digital services, platforms, and technologies. When so much of our ability to learn, live, and speak freely is determined by the designs of private corporations and so-called black-boxed algorithms, how free are we really? What does freedom mean in the digital era? And more importantly, what should it mean? That's the topic of a new series between Project Censored and the Real News Network, The Long Silicon, Power and Censorship in the Digital Era. We'll share that with you today on the Project Censored Show. Stay tuned. Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes by the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you probably own the menu. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Recently, Project Censored teamed up with The Real News Network, therealnews.com, to put together a three-part series called The Long Silicon, Power and Censorship in the Digital Era. We teamed up with the editor-in-chief at The Real News Network, Maximilian Alvarez. We're doing a three-part series that looks at freedom in the digital era. We'll look at censorship, deplatforming, academic freedom, and more. In this first of the series, we are joined by host Maximilian Alvarez. He's the discussion moderator, editor-in-chief of The Real News Network. Andy Lee Roth, associate director of Project Censored. Allison Butler, Department of Communications at University of Massachusetts Amherst. And also the contributing editor of Academe Blog, John Wilson. Yours truly is also a Q&A moderator for the series. And we're going to share excerpts of these series with you over the next couple Project Censored shows. We hope you enjoy The Long Silicon, Power and Censorship in the Digital Era.
Welcome, everyone, to the first of our special three-part live stream series, The Long Silicon, Power and Censorship in the Digital Era, co-produced by The Real News Network and Project Censored. My name is Maximilian Alvarez. I'm the editor-in-chief here at The Real News. So from debates about cancel culture and no platforming to the digital disappearing of political dissenters and even entire academic conferences, from big tech companies writing their own laws and controlling how people consume news to black-boxed algorithms that determine how global supply chains operate and how much workers get paid. From viral protests around the world to data breaches and cyber warfare, who or what has power in the digital world? Where does that power come from? And how does it shape our lives? In the 21st century, digital technologies have empowered more people than ever to connect, communicate, commerce, and collectively take political action. However, those same technologies, as well as the entities and systems that control them, have altered the very terrain upon which these activities take place, absorbing them and us into networks of transactions and power relations structured to monetize, exploit, and surveil everything they can. The utopian dream that the digital era would make our lives more free and our societies more democratic has given way to a digital reality in which the meaning of freedom and the possibility of democracy are being drastically redefined. So where do we go from here? And how do we prepare for what lies ahead? So this is what we're going to be digging into. And we are so excited and so honored to be teaming up with Project Censored to be putting on this series of live streams. So if you like this one, please share it with your friends. It will be posted on YouTube. So today we have a really, really great panel, and we're going to open up this live stream series with a central question that I think we navigate every day, and that is the question of freedom. How free are we in the digital era, right? And I guess I should say that the whole event that brought Project Censored and The Real News together to put on this series of live streams was a virtual academic conference in October of 2020 on critical media literacy that, ironically enough, was completely deleted from YouTube a few weeks after the conference took place. The archives have never been restored, and this is just one instance of many that remind us of the perilous power imbalances caused by the lack of transparency and democratic accountability when it comes to privatized digital services, platforms, and technologies like the ones that we depend on every single day. So we're going to ask here with our panel, in the digital era, when so much of our ability to live, learn, and speak freely is determined by the designs of private companies and black boxed algorithms, what does it mean to be free? And are we free? And do we need to be fighting for a new definition of freedom in the digital era? So, like I said, I could not be more excited about the amazing panel that we have assembled here to help us tackle this question. And I want to introduce you all to them by having them introduce themselves to you. So why don't we go around the panel and everyone give a nice little introduction of yourself and your work. Why don't we go with Andy to start off?
Andy Lee Roth. I'm a sociologist by training. I come to this panel by way of a sociologist's interest in the social forces that shape the production of media and, in particular, news stories. I've been involved with Project Censored since 2006, and since 2012, I've been the associate director of Project Censored.
Allison, how about you?
I teach at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in the communication department, where most of my work is focused on critical media literacy and bringing media literacy into K-12 classrooms, primarily through teacher education and curriculum development. That's a real sort of area of interest of mine, is making sure that teachers are trained in media literacy so that they can really infuse it in their work.
How about our third panelist?
I'm John K. Wilson. I'm a contributing editor at academeblog.org for the American Association of University Professors. I've written 8 books, including Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom as Enemies, and Trump Unveiled, Exposing the Bigoted Billionaire. I was a fellow last year with the University of California National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement. And one of the things I did as part of that fellowship was produce a report about freedom of the press on college campuses.
I wanted to actually go back around the table now that we've gotten to know a bit about our amazing panelists and ask you to say a little bit more about how the question of freedom figures into your work and just into your daily concerns.
Thinking about the question of, is freedom possible in the digital era, from the standpoint of my work with Project Censored, the first thing I think about are the kind of classic First Amendment freedoms: freedom to speak, freedom of the press, and the right to assemble in public. And I think it's important to try to unpack those things, because they're often treated in public conversations about media and news. They're often treated either as abstract ideals or as kind of politicized concepts. And so I think it's important to just begin by asking, well, what do we mean by freedom of speech or freedom of the press? Usually, when we talk about free speech, the emphasis is on the rights of an individual to speak. And I think I would say that the work I've done with Project Censored has sensitized me to the importance of considering the flip side of that, if you will, to thinking about the idea of free speech in terms of the public's right to hear, right? Or if we're talking about freedom of press, the public's right to know. What do people need to hear and know in order to sustain diverse and dynamic publics, and ultimately to sustain democratic self-government? One of the sources that's been very helpful to me on this is faculty member in communications and journalism at the University of Southern California, Mike Anani, and a book of his called Networked Press Freedoms that really focuses on this idea of understanding freedom of speech and freedom of the press in terms of the public's right to hear and to know. As I think about that in terms of the project's work, I think it's manifest in two ways. One would be the project's long-term efforts to be critical of corporate news media when the corporate news media fails to provide the public the kind of information that we need in order to be well-informed community members and engaged citizens. The other aspect of the project's work that comes to mind is how the project attempts to champion and celebrate and hopefully promote to a wider public the good work of numerous independent investigative journalists and numerous independent news outlets that in some ways, due to this digital era that we're in a kind of golden age of independent journalism in the United States. But that platform is in competition with a much bigger and more prominent corporate platform. And so part of the project's mission is to try to highlight and to build public awareness of, trust in, and support for independent journalism. And one of the ways that the project has done that since its beginnings in 1976 is by publishing an annual listing of the most important but underreported news stories of the previous year. These are news stories that have been initially brought forward and reported by independent news outlets. Some of the stories that the project has brought forward among its top 25 for the year 2019-2020 would be the story of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and how Native communities are organizing to counter that terrible social crisis. How Monsanto has organized intelligence centers that are intended to target journalists and activists who are engaged in criticism of Monsanto and its products and programs, and how police officers have been implicated in online hate groups from which Facebook has profited. All three of those and nearly two dozen more stories are in this year's Project Censored Yearbook, State of the Free Press 2021, and they all represent efforts by independent journalists to basically broaden the public's right to hear and understand important stories, important news reports, and important public issues that have simply been marginalized or excluded altogether by corporate news media. So I would say in terms of where I come from through my work at Project Censored, I would say one of the conditions for freedom, however we might define that in the digital era, would be a robust and functioning independent press.
So Allison, what about you? How does the question of freedom figure into your work and just your kind of daily concerns about the state of this world that we've got here?
In terms of freedom and coming into my work, it's really through about asking questions about freedom as the freedom to do something, but also the freedom from something, right? The notion of being free from some degree of harm or misinformation. And I think we can come up with far and away too many examples of harm and misinformation in our current environment, as well as certainly our long history of this. I think we often shorthand the First Amendment to that brief phrase of freedom of speech. But I think another way of looking at this is this question of freedom from, or this exploration of freedom from. The specific language is Congress shall make no law. And then it goes into the whole thing about religion. But just to talk in this case specifically about free speech, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. This is in many ways for us as individuals a protection. So that's something I talk about with students a lot, which is what is this notion of freedom as a form of protection. And one of the things that Andy was talking about was what the corporate media leave out. I think there's a lot of talk and analysis that needs to be done on the misinformation that we are reading, the skewing, the bias, et cetera. But I think a real important conversation is also what's not there. What is the corporate media ignoring for their own benefit? So I think part of our work in critical media literacy is not only the analysis of what's there, but also the absence of data is data in this case. What's not there? What isn't being discussed? What seems to be left out? And is it really actively being ignored so that we can look at freedom as both my freedom to do as well as my protection from? And I think that this past 14 months of COVID has certainly shown that in terms of how polarizing the word freedom has become when it's about mask wearing. I am free to not wear a mask because that's my choice. That impinges on other people's freedoms. Whereas there might also be a way of saying, I am supporting the freedom of my community by wearing a mask. And so we can see how these conversations get twisted and turned. And I think my job, the way that I want to address this, is to put a pause on those conversations, put a momentary pause and say, what are we doing with this language? What are we trying to do? What are we trying to not do? And what might be a way that we could look at protecting ourselves and being protected by taking apart those words?
It's really, really interesting to think about. Milton Friedman famously said, the freedom to swing my fist is limited by the proximity of your face. And the reality of COVID, when you mentioned that, Allison, it was like, well, that kind of gives lie to this notion of the individual sphere of freedom when our actions, in fact, do inhibit the freedom of others, like through transmitting a virus because we want to flout any sense of social solidarity by wearing a mask and protecting others from passing on that disease. So, John, what about you? Where does the question of freedom come in for you?
For me, academic freedom is really analogous to the idea of digital freedom because it is the idea that there's a higher aspiration going on. There's an idea that academic freedom and academic institutions have a greater freedom than you might find in the rest of society. And that was the great hope, I think, of the internet and the digital era, that we would find in these internet institutions a greater standard of freedom than you would find in the regular society. And certainly for academic freedom, I think the idea is that the university is not just another corporation, that students are not customers, that faculty are not just regular employees, that there's something about the enterprise of higher education that requires this greater freedom. It's an essential part of the work that people do within higher education. And I think the same is true of the internet, that it is something inherent in the idea of the digital technology, that we need to aspire to something greater. But of course, while freedom is possible in the digital age, censorship is also possible. And we've seen that a lot at colleges and universities, as well as what big tech is increasingly doing. Linfield University in Oregon banned faculty email listservs and then fired a professor for posting criticism online and on social media of the administration. So you have these very real acts of censorship, and I could detail for you case after case after case. What to me is really interesting also is that a lot of the discussion about censorship, whether it's on campus or in digital media, in the mainstream media, it has become centered on the idea that conservatives are the ones being oppressed, being overwhelmingly silenced. And in reality, the opposite is often the case, that you have an enormous amount of censorship of the left and of progressives going on by big tech. And you have on college campuses of the many cases of faculty getting fired for using social media, for tweeting something offensive. Almost all of these cases have been cases of progressive, of left-wingers, and almost none of their names are known even within academia, or certainly not to the general public. We are getting a distorted picture of what kind of censorship is going on. And that, I think, is in many ways distorting the debate that happens about what freedom is possible and what freedom we can aspire to have.
I think that's spot on. And I mean, for anyone who hasn't delved into John's work, I highly, highly recommend that you do. You know, there's no quicker way to get yourself censored or silenced or fired than to be a vocal opponent to Israeli apartheid of Palestinians, right? Supporting of the BDS movement. That'll get you censored. And in a hurry, we know that already. We just published a piece in the Real News by Lisa Sloane McRae about the account Hood Communist being just wiped off of Twitter with really no notice or explanation and no recourse, really showing, as we all said, that this goes far beyond the case of the disappearing conference that brought us all together. So I want to dig into that in a second. I guess just to follow up on all of your great comments, I wanted to say for my own part, where this question of freedom centers, I think obviously as the editor-in-chief here, I think a lot about media. I think about the free press. I think about what it's meant to do and how we as engaged democratic citizens make use of it, what it makes us free to do and be. That's, I think, where I would piggyback on everyone else's great comments to say that in a lot of ways, I am constantly thinking about the question of freedom to be and how the freedom to be ourselves is complicated, especially in the digital era, when we depend on so many technologies that condition us in conscious and unconscious ways to be something else. There are algorithms that are pushing us in certain directions. While we may feel free, while we may feel like we are expressing our free human agency, we are in fact doing anything but, because we are being shuttled and channeled and canaled into predictable patterns that people can make money off of in a lot of cases. People can surveil, people can predict. And so then what does that question of freedom mean when so much of our raw human agency, or what we believe to be our human agency, is kind of eroded, right, by that sort of conditioning, which is always part of life? We're always conditioned by our culture, by our place, by the people that we're around. But I think for anyone who even saw that you know, terrible Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, right, I think people realize that we are all, in some sense, being conditioned by the tools that we use. The tools that we use are always, in some way, using us. And in the digital era, that has become more pronounced than ever. And I think it really does complicate the question of freedom. So we're not going to come to one final answer to the question of this panel, because there's not one way to approach this question, nor one way to interpret it. We are all kind of looking at this from different and overlapping angles. But I wanted to, again, bring us back to the event that brought us all together, the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas, which was put on in October 2020. And again, by a cruel irony, the conference on critical media literacy was wiped off the face of YouTube. So I wanted to actually bring in my fellow moderator, who's going to be taking over the second part of this panel. Mickey, why don't you also introduce yourself real quick and then give us a little breakdown of what happened with this conference.
Hi, Max. Thanks so much. By the way, the conference has now been restored. It is now up online, but this is a recent development. It is not at projectcensored.org. It now lives at the Critical Media Project, a site that's hosted at USC from the Annenberg School of Communication. Clinical professor Allison Trope there runs a fabulous program called the Critical Media Project. This conference was a conference about critical media literacy. There were several parts of the conference that talked about algorithmic oppression, gatekeeping. Sophia Noble, author of Algorithms of Oppression, was one of the keynote speakers, ironically talking about online censorship, deplatforming. Andy Lee Roth at Project Censored, where I'm director, has written about YouTube deplatforming algorithmically of LGBTQI channels and so forth. This has been in a couple of our books. We've written about it on our website, projectcensored.org. This was a bunch of academics talking about media literacy and censorship and teaching media literacy. They were gone. There was no rhyme or reason. There was no explanation, nothing. It just went into the ether as if it never existed. The channel was disappeared entirely. And so we contacted numerous people that were independent journalists that we know, because we know a lot of those folks. And we said, somebody should try to look into this with us, help us out. And Alan McLeod, who's a media scholar from the UK, writing for Mint Press News, also writes for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Alan wrote a great piece about this conference disappearing. And Alan went poking around, and he couldn't get a straight answer. Basically, they said that the conference was never there. Then they said, wait a minute, we found one of the videos. They had found the keynote, but nothing else. I mean, and there were hours and hours. This was a whole weekend long academic conference. This thing just disappeared. Some people at YouTube apparently found one conference and put it back up, but the rest of it was gone. Now, fortunately, Nolan had all of the video and was able to eventually get it over to Allison Trope at USC. And it's now on the Critical Media Project website, so you can see it. But we still to this day have not received any word, any explanation, nothing as to what happened to this event, why YouTube canceled it, what algorithm may have triggered it. We've already heard about the implications for academic freedom. We've heard about censorship in news media and how it's impacted in digital platforms, and also why we need critical media literacy education to be able to sift through mis and disinformation. So we do not need big tech gatekeepers to help us as a nanny figure to tell us what's true and what's false. even fact checkers, which some people may find very helpful. What we need is an educational system that teaches people how to be in the driver's seat of their own mind so they can determine and decide what's happening. We don't need more sensors. We don't need algorithms. We don't need blacklisting. We need critical media literacy education. And again, ironically, that's what this conference was about that disappeared. But if folks want to see it, you can go to the Critical Media Project now and you can see that. That's where we are right now, is that we were able to get the event back up. But again, no explanation for why it happened. And Nolan and Allison Butler and a number of great folks are working on the next conference, which will be held next October. So the Project Censored page has an announcement, the CMP page at USC does, and so I'll make sure I put that in there as well.
I'm so glad to hear that that development has happened. The bare fact, as we were just saying, right, is that the original conference that was entirely disappeared from YouTube, as far as YouTube is concerned, like that is gone and it never existed. How do you get something restored when you saw it exist, you were part of it, but the entity that was hosting it is telling you they had no record of it? It feels like Kafka's novel, The Castle. You're just constantly weaving your way through this dystopian world, trying to get an answer when really there is no way that you can get that answer because no one believes that you deserve that answer. We all just have to adjust ourselves to this terrain that we're on. And so I guess that's what I wanted to ask. What does this tell us about that terrain? Going into this panel, I was kind of thinking back to that digital utopian era at the turn of the 21st century, when we had this techno-utopian faith that the internet and all the digital technologies that were going to come were going to make us more free. They were going to allow us to connect and share and communicate across the world, right? In a lot of ways, they did. We don't want to say that they didn't. We understand that they did. We are living in a fundamentally different world than the one in which I grew up, in which all of us grew up. What actually is this world? So let me start with Andy. What does this case of the disappearing conference tell you about the laws of the terrain that we're operating on in the digital world?
When you finally are able to say, hey, what happened? All these 20 hours of conference video simply disappeared, and YouTube's response is, that never existed. As if you're crazy. We know that's not true because a number of people, as Mickey mentioned, were using various segments of the conference, various videos from the conference as teaching tools. But the official response was, we have no record of that. If you can prove that you uploaded it, good luck. And you mentioned Kafka and the Castle. My first reaction was to think of George Orwell and 1984, many memorable things from that dystopian novel, but one of them is the idea of the memory holes, where anything that would be contrary to the interests of the Ministry of Truth is put in a memory hole, which is basically a chute that goes down to a place where those papers, those documents are incinerated and there's no record left of them. But as I thought about it more, even though that metaphor was appealing, some of my training from being a grad student studying the history of news at UCLA came back to me, and I was reminded of a theory of news production and distribution that was very popular in the 1950s, but has since fallen from favor. This idea of news gatekeeping is newly relevant in the 21st century in this digital era. Very briefly, the idea of news gatekeeping was developed in a couple of canonical studies in the early 1950s by David Manning White and Walter Gieber, who looked at how news editors at local and regional newspapers, how they decided what stories that were coming across the wire service ought to be included in that day's edition of the paper. The editor was in a position of allowing some information to pass through to become public knowledge in the form of that day's newspaper edition, and other information to be excluded. That model was predominant in sociology studies of the production of news for probably a couple decades. It still is notable today, I suppose, but it was overshadowed by newer developments, including models of framing and agenda setting. And Michael Shudson, who was a historian of the sociology of news, commented on the gatekeeping model that it was in some ways a useful metaphor, but his critique was that it assumed that news was this preformed thing that arrived and the editor either let it through and in the paper or excluded it. And Shudson very correctly said, No, news is a far more complex entity than that. It's news is constructed. It's not a preformed thing. And that was kind of a nail in the coffin of gatekeeping theory as a predominant sociological explanation for how news is produced and distributed. I started thinking about this after the YouTube censorship of the news conference because it seemed newly relevant. In this case, YouTube and many of the other big tech platforms that we rely on a daily basis now are not journalistic entities. They don't even think of themselves, for instance, in the case of Facebook, as being media platforms. Zuckerberg has testified to that effect before Congress, that Facebook is not a media platform. It's something else. And there are self-interested reasons for him to claim that. But my point here is that if you think of a kind of new type of gatekeeping, these big tech companies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, are making decisions about what kind of news we see and hear, the kinds of things the public has a right to know, even though they don't see themselves as engaged in journalism. And so the old critique of gatekeeping, that it treated news as this pre-constituted thing that wasn't being shaped by the editors themselves, is actually now that critique is sidelined because the entities that are engaged in gatekeeping in the 21st century, in the digital age, are also not interested in the production of news. They're simply interested in profiting off of news as yet another thing that can be circulated through their social networks. And so I argue in an article that was published by the Markaz Review in March of 2021 that this new gatekeeping is a grave danger to the integrity of journalism and ultimately to the public's ability to be well-informed and therefore engaged in the democratic process.
It is a tried and true tactic of the Silicon Valley set. The gig companies like Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and Postmates, one of their main arguments for why their workers are not workers is that they say, we are not a transportation company. We're a technology company. And it's like, man, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. You can say you don't feel that way. Zuckerberg can say, we're not a media company. Well, that's what everyone uses it for. So what does it matter what you call yourself? John, I wanted to bring you in here and ask, building off everything that we're talking about here, from the conference outwards, what does all this tell you about the waters that we're swimming in and what the rules are and who's making them and how we're playing by them?
Well, I want to emphasize this is not just this one conference. This is happening in lots of different places. Most famously, I think, is San Francisco State University, where the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies program organized some events that were actually banned by big tech, by multiple big tech companies. In September, they planned an event with Leila Khaled, who's a Palestinian activist who participated in an airplane hijacking over 50 years ago. And various groups had called for this event to be banned. The university refused to ban it, but Zoom and Facebook actually banned it. And then in the middle of the event, YouTube took down the event. And this created an enormous backlash from advocates of academic freedom who were deeply concerned that now big tech companies were, in essence, banning events that were approved of at universities. And this actually led to some important reforms. So earlier this month, Zoom issued a statement under pressure from all these groups stating that it was supporting academic freedom, was going to let universities have control over these events except where they violated the law. And it seemed like we were about to enter in a new age of freedom from the censorship. And then Zoom immediately censored the next event with the Leila Khaled that was at San Francisco State University that was titled, Whose Narratives, What Free Speech for Palestine? And the answer is no free speech for Palestine from Facebook or Eventbrite or Zoom, as well as YouTube. And so you have a real problem now of what is Kafkaesque about this is, of course, there's no explanation about it. And that's one of the things the history of academic freedom brings us, that one of the ways the AUP and other groups really tried to establish academic freedom was not just to get people to agree to a principle, but to get institutions and universities to agree to procedures and policies so that when there is a punishment of someone or a censorship of someone, that there's due process, that there's an explanation of why this has to happen, that there's an appeal process, and that there are advocacy groups out there who are holding institutions accountable when they fail to meet these standards. And so I think there needs to be that. Now that we're seeing the big tech is committed to censorship, we need to demand of big tech that they actually provide due process, that at least they provide the explanations. The first step, I think, in trying to prevent censorship is forcing the censor to explain themselves, to justify themselves, to publicly explain why they need to repress freedom of speech. Because it's a very difficult thing in many cases to convince people of, that a Zoom session needs to be banned because it's going to endanger someone. The other thing we need to do within academia and certainly outside is create alternative institutions, create projects like Project Censored to monitor what big tech is doing, and to create alternative outlets like USC is doing to host what they censor, so that there is still some part of the internet that is free.
In a couple minutes here, I'm going to pass things over to Mickey, but I guess just to synthesize this a bit, if anything, the past 50 minutes have shown us that even three live streams is not enough to talk about the big questions that we're trying to talk about with this series. We do not want to give anyone the impression that we're giving the final word on any of this. If anything, we hope that this has unlocked a whole host of questions that we can all go investigate on our own and together, but really start asking better questions, I think, is what we're hoping to get from a lot of this. But to build on your point, John, about the necessity of alternative institutions, it may be obvious, but I think it's still worth saying that perhaps when we started eking our way into the 21st century, the digital realm felt like a virtual version of the real reality that we lived in every day. It's hard for us to even wrap our heads around what the digital world is when we're so thoroughly involved in it, when it's such a part of our lives. It's not what it was, right? It isn't this kind of thing that you can go on for maybe a few minutes or a thing that maybe a few people have. It is a necessity. It is a part of our daily lives. The services that we use, the communications that we have, the commerce that is made possible through digital technologies. Well, if that is the case, if the kind of digital world of which we're a part is a fundamental aspect of our being, the functioning of our society, then it starts to become all the more perilous and terrifying to realize that that world is governed entirely, almost entirely, by the designs of businesses, algorithms that are calibrated to serve certain ends. And they are not necessarily the ends that we think they are. The businesses that we depend on that run so much of the digital world, they're not there to just offer stuff for free. They're trying to get something from us. And we depend on so much of this digital world that is almost entirely run by the interests of private entities. People, especially on the right, have said for years that they want government to be run like a business. This is what it looks like, right? This is what government run like a business is. It's no accountability. It's everything guided towards the ends of making profit, lack of accountability, lack of transparency, no one to go to with grievances. And the last thing I wanted to say and really emphasize is that this isn't just what government run like a business would look like. This is government run like a business. One of the points that I'm always hammering home is that the market, what we call the market, is a form of government, even if we don't call it that. And that's true out of everything that we've been saying here. The ways that we act, the ways that we can communicate, they're governed by these private entities that can take our ability to exist in the digital world away at the drop of a hat. So Andy, I saw you had a follow-up.
Alice and I began by talking about the First Amendment and First Amendment freedoms of speech and assembly and press. But of course, the First Amendment says Congress can't stifle those things. Congress shouldn't stifle those things. The First Amendment, as Allison said, is a protection for us as members of this societal community, but it says nothing about corporations. So in line with what you're saying, Max, but then I wanted to retrieve something that you said a moment ago and just add a layer to it, if I may. You talked about how at the beginning of the 21st century, the digital world seemed like it was in some sense connected to the real world, maybe more than it perhaps is or seems now. But I think when we're talking about algorithms, one of the most important points to be reminded of over and over and over again is that if algorithms are built upon existing human prejudices, even if the algorithm itself is ostensibly, objectively viewpoint neutral, the algorithm will simply add to deeply sedimented pre-existing social inequalities. And this is not just me asserting this. This is the point that is made by numerous studies. Sophia Noble, who Mickey mentioned earlier, was one of the keynote speakers at this conference we've been talking about. Sophia Noble, the author of Algorithms of Oppression, Virginia Eubanks on Automating Inequality, Kathy O'Neill on Weapons of Math Destruction. These are all about how algorithms in multiple dimensions of human life, not just what gets filtered or censored online, how algorithms basically bake in pre-existing prejudices and then reproduce them as if they are the results of these content-neutral decisions that have nothing to do with any human agency. And that's, I think, one of the most deeply misunderstood things about algorithms. And when we talk about critical media literacy, I think a fundamental component of that in the digital era has got to be algorithmic literacy. This is as simple as saying it's important to understand the search engines we use are not neutral information sources. The social media feeds through which many of us receive news and information about the world are not neutral information sources. I'm saying something that you, just in slightly different words, something that you were saying a moment ago, Max. The algorithms that drive these things, our search engines, our social media feeds, serve to reproduce in many ways existing inequalities, but they do it in subtle ways that we're not privy to because these algorithms are considered by the companies that have developed them to be proprietary intellectual property, which means I mentioned this idea of sociological studies of gatekeeping a while ago. Back in the 1950s, David Manning White or Walter Gieber could go and study in a newsroom how an editor makes a decision about which stories to include in the paper and which stories to exclude. There can be no contemporary David Manning White or Walter Gieber today because Google and Facebook and all these other big tech platforms consider those algorithms to be proprietary, and they have no interest in having any public access to those algorithms. They aren't even interested in having non-public third-party access to how those algorithms work, despite the fact that we have all kinds of circumstantial evidence that these algorithms are deeply biased in so many ways.
The algorithm learns what your preferences are. It adjusts the search results to those preferences and starts funneling you the results that it thinks you want. So for viewers, you take that basic principle and you apply it to a society that has a lot of problems, that has a lot of deep existing inequalities that are going to be reproduced to reflect that the society that exists, then we've got a really big problem on our hands. So Mickey, I'm going to toss things over to you, my man.
Thanks so much, Max. This has been a stellar conversation. I want to start with John Wilson, because if you don't know the work of Academe Blog and the work of the American Association of University Professors and people that fight staunchly for academic freedom, please familiarize yourself with them, because it's extremely important. And it overlaps so extraordinarily with the free press, free speech, free expression clauses. So many of these corporations that we say have a right to exist in the marketplace aren't subject to the First Amendment. But let's go back a second. And then, John, I want to flip it over to you and then go to Allison and Andy. We taxpayers, we're citizens. We're not consumers. We're not shoppers of democracy and candidates. We are citizens of a society that have rights. And among those rights, the right to access information. You look at Article 19 under the UN Declaration of Human Rights. It talks about the right to be heard as well as to express oneself. Well, that's all modeled off of what we saw in the Constitution. So these big tech companies are by proxy operating with government support. There is no Google without DARPA and the Pentagon. None of it. There's no Google. There's no social media. There's no Facebook without the federal government and people working inside of government with taxpayer-funded money. This is a purposeful ruse that's been set up like an offshore tax haven, if you will, for the metaphor. that allows companies to say, well, what are we going to do? And how are we going to, you know, we can't really go and do that. Or the government will say, well, we're not censoring. I guess they're deciding who they want to do business with. Well, look, I think that academia, in the best ideal sense, and when we talk about the importance of public education, John Wilson, why academic freedom is so important is because it's buttressed on the idea that free expression, free flow of information is a necessity for a robust, healthy, self-governing society. How do you see the solutions of what you're doing at AcadeemBlog and the work you do promoting academic freedom as a bigger part of the solution societally as it bleeds into a lot of these other areas? John Wilson.
I often come with this with some skepticism about trying to find easy solutions. I think there are solutions, but they're not easy. I'm skeptical of the algorithms, but I'm also a little skeptical of human agency, and I'm very skeptical of government agencies. And so I don't see, when you look, for example, at the problems Project Censored identifies with the mainstream media, the solution to that is not to hand over the keys to Donald Trump or Joe Biden and let them decide what fake news is and control the media. The solution is in alternative media. It's in building public media, competing media, criticism of media, all of these kinds of institutions that I think can create that kind of critical force. And likewise with the internet, with big tech, a lot of this is about trying to allow for alternative institutions to be created, not necessarily the government trying to control and micromanage what these tech companies are going to do, because it would often be a worse decision than they're already doing. But instead to try and figure out how can we create these alternatives within academia. If Zoom is censoring the university's events, universities should band together and create their own video conferencing technology, just as universities have run their own internet service providers and email for years. There isn't a technological barrier to universities and other institutions creating alternatives to what is currently being done by the corporate media, the corporate tech, all of these other corporate institutions. We need to create these alternatives.
So, Allison Butler, I want to bring it over to you. Mass Media Lit, Action Coalition for Media Education, smartmediaeducation.net. Allison Butler, what are some things that you propose? You are an expert in training teachers in media literacy, critical media literacy education. Let's let you have a go at this and tell people, what are some ways that you can help people be in the driver's seat to determine the veracity of information?
Thanks, Mickey. I think one thing we all need to think about right away when we're talking about this stuff is our digital footprint is immeasurable. We cannot measure our digital footprint. And I think that's something that is really important to recognize. It's not just the websites I go to regularly or my email that I check all the time or some quick thing I'm looking up. Our digital footprint is giant. It's giant from a really young age these days. So I think we need to do a lot of self-reflection. You know, the corporate media constructs a space where we are, quote unquote, best served. Take that loosely, of course, where we are best served as docile beings. It's absolutely an exercise of freedom to question the content, to question the production, to question what we see, to question what's behind the scenes. So I would say a number one strategy is to really start by asking the questions. It's about acknowledging that there's a lot more out there that we don't know. And how do we begin to really exercise that questioning muscle? I work with students who, when they start to figure out what's going on, they get really angry with themselves. How come I didn't know this before? Sometimes they'll get angry with the institution of education, that sort of broad space of education, and say, how come nobody ever taught me this before? And I take a couple steps back and say, how about we learn it now? That anger is really self-directed as like, whoa, I've been missing something. No, that's not your fault. That's how the corporate media are designed. They're designed for us to miss a lot of information. Certainly one of the easiest metaphors to apply here is the Wizard of Oz, the old man behind the curtain. In front of the curtain is Oz, this master, but behind the curtain is just a little old dude. What do we do to get behind the curtain? It's about asking those questions. It's about sharing with our students what's out there for them to learn more so that it's not about us dictating. If asking questions is strategy number one, strategy number two is no dictating, no telling. It's too easy, absolutely, but also we need to be able to figure all of this stuff out. We need to be able to embody these lessons so that we can make an informed choice. And so by starting by asking questions and then providing our students, providing our communities, providing our colleagues, and certainly in my work with teacher education, providing pre-service teachers the opportunity, the tools, the resources, et cetera, to start to embody their own learning and their own knowledge of it.
Thank you, Allison Butler. And again, ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education, smartmediaeducation.net, also vice president with us at the Media Freedom Foundation, working with us at Project Censored on so many things. Andy Lee Roth, I want to bring you into this because one of the other questions here that comes is, how do we get behind that curtain? What is behind that curtain? What kind of questions do we ask? Andy?
I mentioned earlier the idea that it's important, I think, just fundamentally to remember that search engines and social media feeds are not neutral conduits of information. That's a beginning foundational understanding, I think. I would say one of the things that we can do in terms of algorithms, this is very simple, but I think it links to something more profound. We should stop using the word Google as a verb to describe a generic online activity. Why should we associate the practice of searching for information with the brand name of a corporation? Another thing I would say that's, I think, very simple, and it won't solve the problem ultimately, but it's a stopgap measure that's undermined some of the pervasive power of algorithms to shape the kind of news and information that we're privy to, is to connect directly to the news organizations that you know are displaying firm commitments to ethical journalism. Connect directly with them rather than relying on social media feeds or other ways, other indirect ways of getting information about them. So go to these trustworthy news organizations' websites, sign up for their email lists or their RSS feeds, a very early 21st century concept. Subscribe to the print versions of those outlets, if there is a print version. By going direct that way, what you're doing is you're cutting out the social media platform or the search engine as basically an unnecessary and potentially biased intermediary. Again, that's not going to change the world, but if more of us did that, until we get more of the alternative infrastructure that John's been talking about, that I think is crucial to advocate for, until we get it, there are ways to, in effect, work around the existing pathways so that we're less dependent on the algorithms of a Google or a Facebook or a Twitter. I mentioned these are kind of stopgap measures. Ultimately, there are several lawsuits, class action lawsuits against YouTube that aim to force YouTube, not necessarily to expose its algorithms publicly, but at least to make those algorithms available to independent third-party review. And if those lawsuits are successful, that would open up that black box that Max was talking about at the beginning of this program and would allow us to see, okay, how is it that we consistently get Google News promoting transphobic and homophobic views on its news aggregator? Is that the result of biases that have been built into the algorithm itself? Is that simply the result of successful gaming of how the algorithm works by conservatives with anti-LGBTQ agendas or not? But until that time comes, one of those lawsuits is judged in favor of the plaintiffs, we won't know what's in those algorithms. We'll only know what their effects are. And we have to then figure out ways to work around the kind of epistemic inequality that is a condition of how these algorithms operate.
Liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.